The opinions and commentary expressed in the following presentation do not reflect the views of this station, the Economic Club of Indiana, or the Economic Club's agents or sponsors. Support for the Economic Club of Indiana is provided by the Lumina Foundation, with a goal to increase the percentage of Americans with high-quality degrees and credentials to 60% by the year 2025. Focused on ensuring an accessible, responsive, and accountable higher education system.
Welcome to the Economic Club of Indiana. Today's presentation is from Dr. Alvin Roth of Stanford University and the winner of the Nobel Prize in Economics.
When we think of markets, most of us think about commodities where prices seem to do all the work to bring together buyers and sellers. So the way that works, if the buyer can afford the price of the product the seller is asking, then a deal takes place. The old rules of supply and demand, which work supposedly on fixed principles and when left to their own devices without a whole lot of human help or engineering. Our guest today, Dr. Alvin Roth, is an expert in markets and in how to make them work better, in matching them, markets especially where prices often aren't allowed to do all the work. In his newest book, Who Gets What and Why, Dr. Roth examines this theory where markets still have buyers and sellers. But also in these markets, the buyers and the sellers have to find a way to find and then choose each other, and often with a lot of congestion in the process. Dr. Roth argues that this phenomenon of finding and choice is more often the rule than the exception in the 21st century marketplace. Having an interest in using economics to solve real-life problems, Dr. Roth's work in intricate computer algorithms has opened up whole new opportunities in often challenged markets, especially matching prospective donors and recipients for organ transplants, facilitating school admissions, filling job openings, and even making dating sites survivable. His insights and resulting system have both improved and, in the case of healthcare and kidney donations, have worked to save thousands of lives by allowing patients to effectively swap incompatible donors with compatible ones from other donor-patient pairs. However, his revolutionary work continues to expand to other areas, including bringing up-to-date and outdated system of matching medical graduates with residency hospitals, and even in looking at how healthcare markets can function more effectively. In one especially daunting feat, Dr. Roth has managed to tackle successfully the optimal matching of eighth grade students with their best choices for high school among hundreds of free public high schools in big urban areas like New York City and Boston. It's groundbreaking and really novel contributions like these to market design that earned Dr. Roth a Nobel Prize in Economics in 2012. He's been referred to more than once as an economist that saves lives, and he's going to talk about that. But he's not your typical economist. In fact, he started out and really remains in many ways a really good engineer. Born in New York to two school teachers, he dropped out of high school his junior year. While taking weekend engineering courses at Columbia, a professor encouraged him to apply to the university. He was admitted, did pretty well, and eventually earned an undergraduate and doctorate in engineering. A professor at Harvard, when awarded the Nobel Prize, he is now the McCaw Professor of Economics at Stanford, where he earned his PhD a few years ago. Many years ago, in fact. Dr. Roth sees economists not only as experts on the economy, but fundamentally as enlightened engineers who can help make the economy work better, and I think that's how he sees himself, which is just pretty wonderful. As he says in his book, Who Gets What and Why, as we start to understand better how markets and marketplaces work, we realize that we can intervene in them. We can redesign them and fix them when they're broken. We can start new ones when that will be useful. It's a bold, it's a hopeful mission, and we're excited to welcome Dr. Roth here today to tell us more about it, to tell us how it can happen in a world that needs both better ideas and more effective actors to put them into motion. Dr. Roth.
Okay, well, thank you very much. So I said I'm going to talk to you a little bit about market design and about school choice. As David said, I wrote a book. It came out 2 years ago. So now, in the way of books, it's getting translated into other languages. And a book about markets that's translated into languages reminds us that markets and languages have a lot in common. They're both ancient human artifacts. And just as there are lots of different languages, there are lots of different kinds of markets and marketplaces. They're not all the same. In particular, as David mentioned already, not all markets are commodity markets. But I think that often when we think about markets, we think about commodity markets. So the New York Stock Exchange is a commodity market. When you're buying 500 shares of AT&T, you don't care which shares you're buying. They're all the same. You don't care who you're buying from. You don't worry that whether the person you're buying from has taken good care of those shares while he's had them. And he doesn't care who he's selling to. He doesn't worry whether you'll take good care. And that's the nature of commodity markets. And commodities, of course, have to be designed. I'm not going to talk about the design of commodity markets today. But one way to think about it is that God made wheat, but the Chicago Board of Trade made number two hard red winter wheat. And that's what you can buy a contract on, you know, if you're a bakery. But in a lot of markets, you can't anonymously buy 5,000 bushels of number two hard red winter wheat. You care who you're dealing with. And the prices don't do all the work. And in some matching markets, and I'll talk today particularly about school choice, in some matching markets, we don't even let prices do any of the work. So I teach at Stanford, where it's expensive to go to Stanford. It's not that prices don't matter at all, but prices aren't what determines who gets to go to Stanford. Stanford does not raise tuition until demand and supply are equal. It doesn't choose its freshman class by raising the price until just enough people want to come to fill our seats. Instead, there's other market clearing processes for college admissions. There's applications and essays and maybe interviews. So marketplaces like Stanford, you can't just go to Stanford, you have to be admitted. And in the same way, labor markets are like that. You can't just show up for work at Google, you have to be hired. And Google can't just decide who to hire, they have to compete with Facebook. So these are matching markets. They're markets in which you can't just choose what you want, even if you can afford it, you also have to be chosen. So matching markets have elements of courtship in them. They're a little bit like marriage. You can't just choose your spouse. You also have to be chosen. So a lot of markets, of course, fall somewhere between pure commodity markets where you deal anonymously and the job of the market is just price discovery, finding the prices at which supply equals demand at every moment for all the commodities. A lot of markets have some element of that. Prices are important, but also some element of matching. So let's think about matchmaking as a market activity. And of course, one kind of matchmaking is about marriage and dating. And with computerized markets, we're now indeed seeing a lot of dating sites. And when you're designing a dating site, one of the things you have to do is deal with congestion, right? If in many dating sites, you can see lots of people on the other side of the market. But people with attractive pictures will get lots of emails, and the emails will start to be uninformative and hard to deal with. And the marketplace stops doing well what it's supposed to do, which is aggregate all the private information in the market about who likes what and how they might make a match. And so the design problem is largely a congestion problem. And there are lots of kinds of matchmaking going on the internet and on apps these days. You know, Upwork is a labor market where you can hire coders to do computer tasks. Uber and Lyft, of course, are disrupting the taxi cab industry, matching travelers to drivers. And there are more and more of these markets taking place on the internet, which incidentally makes them easy to study, because when you have a computer-assisted market, you have to make its rules very explicit. They have to be coded so that all the interactions can be carried out on a computer. They also make markets ubiquitous, right? I've got a smartphone in my pocket, so I've got a market in my pocket where I can buy an airline ticket or a hotel room or almost anything else, and pretty soon Amazon will drive a drone in here to deliver it. So let's think about what marketplaces do. And a little bit. I'm going to use the word markets and marketplaces interchangeably, which is just a little lazy of me to do. One way to think about the difference is that economists study markets, but businesses build marketplaces. And so marketplaces are the places where markets happen, and they have to accomplish some tasks. The marketplace has to accomplish some tasks to make the market work well. And I'm going to use Airbnb as my example, but I think I'm giving a pretty general set of rules here about what marketplaces have to do in general. And so the first thing marketplaces have to do to make markets successful is they have to help make the market thick. They have to bring lots of people together who want to transact. So in the case of Airbnb, we're talking about travelers and hosts. So Airbnb started as a website based in San Francisco, and the way they initially got market thickness was they bought up some of their competitors, like Crashpad in England. And once Airbnb had a site in London as well as in San Francisco, they started to have a marketplace where if you wanted to travel, you could travel to either San Francisco or London and find a room, and people in both places could use the site to help organize their travels, and they quickly spread to be a very worldwide company, as you know. Now, once they had a thick market, they had to deal with congestion. Congestion is a problem of success. It's a problem of when you succeed in making your market thick, so that there are lots of participants. Now the question is, how are you going to help them sort among all the options? So think about the problem that hotels face and how it's different from what Airbnb faces. Because now Airbnb is a giant hotel company. It competes with other giant hotel companies. So I stayed last night at the Conrad Hotel. And when you want to make a reservation at the Conrad, you call them up and you ask if they've got a room on the night you want. Supposing they could only talk to you about one room at a time, right? So you'd call up the Conrad and you'd say, have you got a room for me Monday night? And the receptionist would say, what room would you like? And you'd say, how about room 1102? She'd say, I'm so sorry, 1102 is booked. And then while you said, wait, you know, she would hang up and you'd have to call again and say, how about room 1103? That's a little bit Airbnb's problem, because many of their hosts only offer one guest room or one apartment or one property that they're renting. So if you're trying to rent my guest room or my apartment and it's booked, then you have to hang up and try again with someone else. So you can easily see that in order for Airbnb to overcome this congestion problem, in order for them to successfully compete with hotels, they had to deal with congestion in a way that the Conrad Hotel doesn't. What makes the Conrad Hotel uncongested for making a reservation is that when I call up, the receptionist can see all the rooms. And she looks at all of them and tells me whether any one of them is available. But when I try to reserve your apartment on Airbnb, if it's not available, I have to find another. So Airbnb has made, in the course of their evolution, they've made a number of incremental changes to deal with congestion. If you try to reserve my apartment on Airbnb, even before I've confirmed your reservation, it disappears from other people's screens and apps so that they're not queued up and I have to say no to six people whenever I give the apartment to one person. They also have instant reservation that they're trying to propagate through their system so that so I can look and see what apartments are available, and sometimes I don't have to wait to be confirmed. I can see that it's available and confirm it. So they're dealing with congestion pretty successfully. By and large, we don't see big markets that have failed to deal with congestion. Right? That's a cause of marketplace failure. If you're not thick, then if you don't make a thick market, then maybe we've never heard of you. And if you can't deal with congestion, then we quickly get tired of using your marketplace. And again, think about how supermarkets deal with congestion, right? This is a universal problem. Supermarkets have signs on their aisles that you don't have to go down every aisle. They tell you where you can find the canned fish if that's what you're looking for. So marketplaces have to help markets be thick. They have to help them deal with congestion. And then they have to be safe, reliable places, right? So Airbnb, if you'd be glad to know if you're renting your guest room to me that I've been a successful guest elsewhere and that I won't leave your apartment in a shambles. And if I'm renting your guest room or your apartment, I'd be glad to know from your reputation, from the fact that you've successfully rented it in the past, that when I arrive, it's going to look like the picture. That's a picture of your apartment and not an apartment somewhere else with a better view. So marketplaces have to be thick, they have to deal with congestion, and they have to help the participants feel that the market is reliable and safe. So I've been involved in a number of market design projects. Some of them, I mean, they're all matching markets. Some of them are labor markets where wages, prices play a big role but aren't what determines who gets what. And some of them are markets like Kidney Exchange and School Choice where we don't allow prices to play any role at all. And today I'm going to concentrate on School Choice because I understand that Indianapolis is on the verge of a unified enrollment system. You already have a lot of school choices, and the question is, how are you going to organize the marketplace to help the market for schools work better? Okay, so this is a market where, for public schools, we don't let prices do any of the work. Thickness in school choice has something to do with unified enrollment, right? If every school has a different application process, then it's a little bit like Airbnb before they made it easy to look at lots of different apartments. If you have to apply separately to every school, it's going to take a while to do that. It might be hard to do. And of course, there'll be children who are admitted, who have many admissions while other children have none. And so it'll take a while for that congestion to resolve itself. So one of the things that a unified enrollment system tries to do, a marketplace for school choice, is deal with that, help make the market thick and then deal with the resulting congestion. And the general idea about markets, you know, often we may not think of school choice as a marketplace because no money is involved, but remember what markets do. Markets aggregate privately held information, right? So the idea is, we don't know where your kid should go to school, but maybe you know. Maybe you have some idea about what would be a good school for your kid. And the question is how to take that information into the assignment process so that it can be used in an efficient way. And if we're going to need your information about which would be good schools for your kid, we have to make it safe for you to convey that information. And as I'm going to show you, not every school choice system makes it safe to convey the information about where you think it would be good for your kid to go. Okay, so let me tell you two quick stories about New York City and Boston. Which had troubled school choice systems, and which my colleagues and I have helped to modify. Okay, so New York City is our biggest municipal school system in the United States. These days, only about 80,000 students graduate from eighth grade in New York each year, and go to high school. And what used to happen back in the early 2000s when I got involved was, Each student was invited to submit a list of choices, you know, first choice, second choice, third choice. Those lists were Xeroxed and sent to the schools on the list, and that constituted your application. Okay? And then the schools made separate admissions decisions, which they conveyed to the New York City Department of Education, which sent out letters to the students, some students, about 17,000 students received multiple admissions, and if you were such a fortunate student, you would get a letter that said, you've been admitted to these three high schools, please choose one. And if in addition you want to be on the waiting list of another school, let us know about that. And only when those students had made their decisions could the high schools admit more students, and new letters would be sent out. And that was a slow, congested process. They only had time for three rounds of letters, and in the end of August, about 30,000 students would remain each year who hadn't been assigned and had to be assigned administratively to schools over which they hadn't expressed any preferences. Right? It was just time ran out. You're 14 years old. You're in ninth grade. You've got to go somewhere. Now, there were some problems with this, and one of them was the one I indicated when I said the lists were Xeroxed and sent to the school principals. If you have a rank order list and it's Xeroxed, and you apply to my school, I'm the principal, and I see that you've applied to my school, but that I'm your third choice, right? You had a different school as your first choice and your second choice. I could possibly adopt the strategy of saying, you know, I'm not going to admit any kids who applied to me as a third choice. I'm only going to admit kids who applied as a first choice. And a lot of principals adopted that policy. And you can immediately see that that process, allowing principals to do that, makes it unsafe for you to reveal your preferences. Because you no longer have choices 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You might just have choice 1. And so instead of revealing which school you think would really be best for your new ninth grader, you have to think, what school is the best school we can get if we claim that it's our first choice? That's very different than revealing what's your first choice and what's your second choice. And what it means is the preference list process became impoverished. It didn't really have the information it was supposed to have, which is where families would like their kids to go. And one thing is for sure, if you don't know where families want their kids to go, you can't send them where they want them to go. So that was a problem. It wasn't safe, and that was understood. I mean, they were in the backpack mail and went home to students. They indicated that you'd better be careful about what you list as your first choice. There was a second problem, which had to do with the history of New York City schools. They actually, I got involved in the first Bloomberg administration. He appointed Joel Klein as his superintendent of schools. But before that, they had many community school districts. They had community boards. They had decentralized their school system. And then they clawed back. They made the market thick by bringing mayoral control back to the city so that you could, a New York City eighth grader can choose among 600 high school programs now instead of a very small number in your immediate neighborhood. But the principals were accustomed to having a lot of power. And one thing they could do effectively in New York, and nowhere else that I've seen, is they could conceal places. They could conceal capacity from the Department of Education. And one reason they wanted to do this is, remember, 30,000 children were being assigned sort of randomly at the end of the process. And by holding back places, you could try to get some control for your school. Instead of getting a random assignment, you could start to do what they called over-the-counter admissions outside of the centralized school system. Okay, so before I tell you what we did for New York, let me tell you about a different but related problem that appeared in Boston. And the reason I'm telling you about them both together is we're able to bring the same solution to both problems. So Boston, when we met Boston Public Schools, they already had a well-established computerized school choice system. So they did not have a congestion problem. Families put down preferences. Students were quickly assigned to schools, and there weren't 30,000 kids left over in August who needed to be assigned. But they had a safety problem. And let me tell you what their system was, because you can see when I describe it that it was designed with the most benign intents. Okay, so in Boston, the principals, unlike in New York, the principals don't play a role in deciding the priority at each school for each child. The Boston Public Schools does that. The district does it. And what they did is they would ask families for lists. This is not just for high schools. This is for little children as well. They would ask people for lists, and they would try to give as many children as possible, their first choice. So this is obviously a benign system. They'd get all these preference lists. They'd see where everyone's first choice was, and they tried to put them in. When more children listed a particular school as first choice than it had capacity for, then they would use the priority that each child had at each school for tiebreakers. They would line them up in order of priority, accept all the ones they could accept that they had capacity for, and reject the rest. And those who didn't get their first choice, they tried to give as many as possible their second choice. If you didn't get your second choice, they tried to give as many students as possible your third choice. So what could be wrong with a system like this? And again, as in New York, it's not safe to reveal your first choice, because your true first choice. Because if you don't get your first choice, there's a good chance that your second choice is going to have filled all of its seats with people who said that it was their first choice. And you might live across the street from a great half-day kindergarten, and because you live across the street, you have a high priority. And if you listed it as your first choice, you would get it. But maybe you need a full-day kindergarten because mom is going back to work. So you list... If you listed a full-day kindergarten for which you didn't live across the street and didn't have high priority, then you might not get it. And now the half-day kindergarten that's right across the street from your house has filled all its seats. So now you're going to drop down through the system and your child will be placed in a school that still had seats available after everyone had gotten their choices. And that won't be typically one of your high-choice schools. So of course, families figured this out. And they spent a lot of time thinking about what school should I list as my first choice? What's the best school I can get by claiming that it's my first choice, which is a very different thing than telling the district what schools you would like your kid to go to. Okay, so what we wanted to do in New York and Boston to help make a marketplace that would successfully elicit the information of where the families want their children to go, we wanted to redesign it to make it safe and to deal with congestion. And one of the advantages of finding out where families would like their children to go is that's valuable information that you can also use to predict changes in policies. Supposing you change some school from a K through 5 to a K through 6, what would likely happen to the other schools? If you don't have the information about which schools people like, you have less ability to predict which schools will need new teachers and things like that. But when you have what's happened since good systems have gone into effect in New York and Boston is they also have better planning information. So let me tell you how we now process the preference lists in New York and in Boston. Okay, and this is, I'm going to tell you about an algorithm. I'm going to do a little magic, do a tiny amount of mathematics from the stage here today, but bear with me. You're going to be able to follow me. This is the deferred acceptance algorithm. The two gentlemen who are pictured are David Gale and Lloyd Shapley. And Lloyd Shapley shared the Nobel Prize with me in 2012. David Gale was no longer living. But the two of them in the 1960s had thought a little bit about the matching problem. And here's how it works. And I'm going to tell you the story about how the algorithm works, the computerized algorithm that processes the list. I'm going to tell you a little bit as if students and schools are doing something in the algorithm. But the way to think about it is these are the internal steps in a computer. So what happens in school choice in New York and Boston is families are asked, please rank schools in order of preference, first, second, third. And the schools in New York, the principals rank students. In Boston, the Boston Public Schools establishes priorities for each student at each school, and those are input as well. And those are the inputs into the computer. And then what the computer does is, I add in blue there at the beginning, these lists are private. So in New York, remember, it used to be that the list was Xeroxed and sent to the principals. That had the bad effect of allowing principals to say, I'll only admit you if you rank me first. So now these lists are still composed, but they're not sent to the principals. So principals cannot adopt a strategy that says, I'll only admit you if you rank me first, because they don't know where they're ranked. Okay? So then what does the algorithm do? Well, each student applies to his or her first choice, and the schools collect all the applications they get by these first choice students. They order them in terms of priority. They see what their capacity is. All the students who are beyond that capacity, they reject. But what's different about what we're going to do now than what I described to you in Boston is the students who aren't rejected are not immediately accepted. Instead, all acceptances are going to be deferred until we see who else applies. Okay? That's why it's called a deferred acceptance algorithm. So at the very first step, people apply to their first choice, and if the school is over capacity, the lowest priority students are rejected. They now go ahead and apply to their next choice. Any student at any stage who's rejected applies to his or her next choice school. The schools look at the new applications they get. They rank them in order of priority. They don't care at what stage the application came in. So if you live across the street from a school, if you have an older sibling who goes to some school, your child will bubble up to the top. They reject the ones who are now beyond capacity, who may be people whose applications were held earlier. Everyone who's rejected applies to their next choice school. And that process continues until there are no more rejections. And only then are the applications that are being held accepted. Okay, so that's how you get the matching of which students go to which school. You wait till all the applications have bubbled through the system, and the children whose application schools are holding when the algorithm stops, those are its entering class. So why is this a good system? Well, let me tell you about two mathematical results. The first is there aren't a student and a school who are not matched to each other who would both prefer to be. Okay, let's think about that. Let me go back to the algorithm. Supposing I'm a school principal, and when I look at my entering class, the entering class I get through this procedure, I notice that that there are some students who I don't have. They're not going to my school, but I wish that they were. Is there any chance that they would also prefer to come to my school? And the answer is no, because the students are going down their list in order, and if there's some student who I would prefer to have than ones I've got, I would have accepted him when he applied to me. And the reason he's not in my school is he never applied to me. And the reason he never applied to me is he got accepted. His application was held by a school that he preferred to me. Okay, so if as a principal there are some students I wish came to my school, they don't return the favor. They don't wish they were in my school. And if I'm a student, supposing I get assigned to my third choice school, is there a chance that my second choice school would have liked to admit me? Well, no, because how did I get assigned to my third choice school? First, I applied to my first choice, and eventually they filled all their spots with people who had higher priority than me. Then I applied to my second choice, and they filled all their spots with people they had higher priority. And that's why I'm in my third choice. So there aren't pairs of schools and students who would rather be together. Okay, and I'll rephrase that for you in a minute. But the other important result, and this is one of the things that I first noticed when I started studying this kind of choice, is that it's safe for families, I said workers here, sorry, it's safe for families to state their true preferences. And why is that true? Well, remember why it wasn't safe to state your true preferences in Boston. It was because if you didn't get your first choice, there was a good chance that your second choice was going to have already filled all its positions. But with the deferred acceptance algorithm, that doesn't happen. If you don't get your first choice, when you apply to your second choice, they rank you in order of your priority. So in the deferred acceptance algorithm, your chance of getting your second choice, in case you're rejected by your first choice, is exactly the same as it would have been if you had listed it as your first choice. And that makes it safe for you to take a chance on the whole day kindergarten that you'd like your kid to go to, even though you don't have priority for that school. And of course, if the school system doesn't know that you'd like your kid to go to a whole day kindergarten, there's no way that they'll be able to assign you to that. Okay, so to put it another way, let's see. Oh, I'm going the wrong way. Sorry. Okay, to put it another way, you can say to school principals, you can't get better students by withholding places. I'm going to show you how that played out in New York. Remember, New York principals would sometimes withhold places because if there are students who you would like better, they're not going to come apply to you. They're already in schools that they like better. And it's safe for families to submit their true preferences, which, among other things, also levels the playing field. It means that it's not just families who have the time and resources to invest in gaming the school choice system who can function in it. It's all families can. The important thing that you have to decide is which schools you would like your kids to go to. And you don't have to understand how the school choice process works, except that it makes it safe for you to state your true preferences. Okay, so let me tell you what happened in New York when we did this. First of all, we got over 70,000 students matched in the first round, and then we did a second round of students who were unmatched and got some more matched. So only 3,000 students didn't receive a school that they had expressed some preference over instead of 30,000. The year before. So that was a big win right there. And you'd sort of expect that given the fact that a computerized algorithm is good at handling congestion. But a more surprising thing happened, something we didn't expect. And so I've got a slightly complicated graph here that I'm showing you. And I'm showing you the first several years of the new system, 2004, 5, 6, and 7. And what each column does is it shows you the number of children who got their first choice, the number who got their third choice. Okay, going up. So the first choice is at the bottom. And what you see is in the second year of operation, 2005, more kids got their first choice. More kids got one of their first or second choices. More kids got one of their first or second or third choices, right? So, and when you go to 2006, you see that again. More kids got their first choice. More kids got one of their first two choices. More kids got one of their first three. No changes in the algorithm were made in those years. What we're seeing here is a change in behavior. We're seeing the New York City principals learning that it's safe to put down your true preferences and you don't need to withhold places. So more places are coming back into the centralized system, and that's why more kids are getting better choices. And then it leveled out. And in fact, as principals understood that it was safe to reveal places, they started doing a little bit what airlines do. They would slightly overbook. There's about a 10% attrition rate in New York City schools. People move in and out of schools. And once you liked the kids you were getting in the centralized system, you would like to get all your kids that way so you could actually admit 10% more kids than you had capacity for, because some of the kids who were matched to you wouldn't show up when their families moved to another city. Okay, so I've already said this. As the market becomes safer, it also became thicker. More people were actually getting their school assignments through the centralized marketplace. Now, appeals are a little bit of an issue. The people for whom these decisions are being made and who are influencing their decisions are 13 and 14 years old in New York. They're in high schools. And so the first year, we had about 300 appeals from students who had received their first choice. So that surprised us. You say, gee, what's the problem? And often the problem was transportation. Often what appeared to happen was that they had met the high school that they liked and applied to at an information session at their high school and hadn't realized, New York City's a big city, that it's far away. And part of the computerized application process, putting in your list of preferences now, as a consequence of this, notifies you if, right, the school system knows where you live and it knows where the schools are. And now, as you try to put in your rank order list, it will notify you if there's, I think, more than 45 minutes transportation by public transportation from your house to the school. You can still list the school, but they don't want you to be surprised that it's far away. So other kinds of information can start to flow through the system so that people can make good decisions about where to go to school. So the old New York City system had some big subset of children, but not a majority of children, getting multiple offers. And as a result, it devolved into a system of waiting lists. And waiting lists are congested. If you have to wait for other people to make decisions before places clear up for you, then the market is moving very slowly. That's sort of the Airbnb problem, or when I wanted to make a hotel reservation, I had to call one room at a time. It would take me a long time to make a hotel reservation, and it would be a painful process, and I might settle for a hotel that wasn't as good as the one I could get if I had been able to see all the options right away. So what markets are supposed to do is aggregate information, and one of the things marketplaces can do is help that information flow more smoothly. So let me sort of end with some general comments. My colleagues and I have now worked in a number of cities to try to make school choice work more efficiently, and I have a number of colleagues, Attila Abdulkadirogo and Parag Pathak are economists, and Neil DeRosen, who's somewhere at a table here, he runs a nonprofit called IPSCI, Innovation in Public School Choice, that has been working here in Indianapolis with a local organization called Enroll Indy, which is trying to bring good school choice to Indianapolis. And is, I understand you're all scheduled to start enjoying that next year. And it's run by Caitlin Hannon, who I think is also here somewhere in this big room. There they are. I see them. So if you want to talk to them, why don't you guys put your hands up for a minute? So if you want to go talk to them, you can do it. Oh, and there's some other people with their hands up. Great, you can talk to them all. and so let me end with just some thoughts about markets, because part of what I'm trying to do in a talk like this is expand your notion about what is a market, a marketplace. You know, maybe you're not thinking about, maybe you're not used to thinking about school assignment as a market. So there are lots of different kinds of markets. And it's only in commodity markets that prices do all the work. In a lot of markets, you care who you're dealing with, and they're matching markets. You can't just go to the school you want to go. You have to be admitted. And to work well, markets have to solve a lot of problems. If they don't solve them all, they don't work well, and they have to help the market be thick, which means one thing it could mean is getting all the schools together into a common admission system so that everyone can look at all the schools at the same time and make their choices. But then you have to deal with congestion, and you have to make it safe. But computerized markets that we're seeing more and more of, you know, think Amazon and Uber, help us deal with congestion much more effectively than we used to be able to. And so it would be a shame not to use that technology to good ends. And so in my book, one of the things I say is, what's a free market? You know, sometimes market design strikes people as an odd thing. You know, are markets really designed? Are they really human artifacts, things that people make? And of course, markets, as I said at the beginning, they're a bit like languages. They're designed, they're human artifacts, but languages are such a collective property of humanity that we normally don't think we can design languages. Of course, we adapt languages to new circumstances. The words internet and smartphone didn't used to exist, but we all know what they mean today. But markets are easier to get control of because they tend to have sometimes owners and interested users and smaller groups of people than languages as a community. And when we speak about a free market, we shouldn't be thinking of a free-for-all with no rules. We should be thinking about a market with rules that let it operate freely, let it do the things that markets have to do, aggregate information and get efficient outcomes. So the analogy I gave in my book is, a market with well-designed rules is like a wheel that can turn freely. It needs an axle and well-oiled bearings. You know, when you think of a wheel rotating, it's not sitting there in space. It's tuned. It has an axle. It has bearings, and someone has to keep those bearings oiled. And a little bit, what I'm doing here is paraphrasing some of the things that Friedrich von Hayek said in his book *A Road to Serfdom*, which was about why free markets are important to free societies. And you know, he says there's all the difference between deliberately creating a system within which competition will work as beneficially as possible, and passively accepting institutions as they are. Probably nothing has done so much harm to what he calls the liberal cause, today we might say the libertarian cause, as the wooden insistence of some liberals on certain rules of thumb, above all the principle of laissez-faire. And he says, the attitude of the liberal towards society, towards markets, is like that of the gardener who tends a plant, and in order to create the conditions most favorable to its growth, must know as much as possible about its structure and the way it functions. And so, let me just leave you with that thought. Market design is an ancient human activity. We've been designing markets and marketplaces since before the invention of agriculture. When archaeologists find stone tools thousands of miles from where they were quarried and shaped, it means that our prehistoric ancestors knew how to trade and travel. So markets evolve incrementally because people change the way they work. And market design is now a part of economics, an engineering part of economics, that's about helping us do some of that self-consciously and cautiously and incrementally to make things work better than they might otherwise
work.
Thank you.
Thank you. I went too long.
Thank you very much. That was terrific. So we just have time for probably a couple of questions here, and because I don't have any yet that have come up to me, I'm going to seize the opportunity. Can you tell us a little bit about how you got involved in something I know is of passionate interest to you, and that's the Kidney Exchange Program? Was that a special mission for you, or how'd that happen?
So it wasn't. I'm often asked that question, and at the risk of giving a disappointing answer, I didn't know anyone who had kidney disease. I got into kidney exchange through the mathematics. I taught for many years at the University of Pittsburgh, which was a big transplant center, and it's about matching, and I started.
And it's a very hard problem.
And it's a very hard problem, and it's an important one. We have 100,000 people this morning waiting for deceased donor kidneys. And we'll only do about 12,000 of those a year, but kidneys are special because healthy people have two kidneys and can stay healthy with one. So if you love someone who's dying of kidney failure, you could maybe give them a kidney. But sometimes you're healthy enough to give someone a kidney, but you can't give a kidney to the person you love. And if I'm in the same situation, then there's an opportunity for exchange. Maybe you can give a kidney to my patient, and I can give a kidney to your patient, and that way two people will get transplants who wouldn't otherwise have. And so economists study exchange. So we got involved that way, and it's grown. It's now a standard part of transplantation in the United States. About 10% of the 6,000 or so living donor kidney transplants we do are arranged through exchange.
And you're doing this all over the world, aren't you?
We are. I'm going to race from here to the airport and go to Barcelona, where the Barcelona Clinic is the big kidney surgery center in Spain.
That's really exciting. We have a question. We've got many questions here, but we have one on about, can matching and the principles you have be used and applied to public transportation in the same way they've been to hotel choices? Could we do it for transit as well?
Well, so I don't know what's going to happen with transit, but there's some chance that public transportation is going to look less like what we always anticipated it would look like and more like Uber. You know, when we start having driverless cars and things like that, it might very well be that you'll be matched to a vehicle. Because Uber is a matching market, of course, and all these others. So I wouldn't be surprised if public transportation in an age when cars might be able to drive themselves is going to look very different than we thought. And, you know, Americans like cars, so our public transportation may look like cars, and then it'll involve matching passengers in cars.
Another question here about whether there's any possibility for applying your algorithm and some sense of order to the business of the politics of electing public officials. Unclear where the question came from. It's not mine.
Yeah. Well, I think I'm going to pass on that.
I understand that. So let me just close with one from you. It's pretty cool to have someone here who's won the Nobel Prize. How did you find out you'd won, and what was it like?
Well, if you live in California, which is 9 time zones away from Sweden, you find out in the middle of the night. And so we had just moved into a temporary apartment at Stanford while we were looking for a house. And we only had one telephone, and it was in my wife's office. She's a serious person. She gets the telephone. Around 3 in the morning, she woke me up and she said, "I think the phone is ringing." And I woke up and it wasn't ringing. So I said, "It's not ringing," and I went back to sleep. But she went down and got the phone, and fortunately, they call you back.
They're prepared for the time problem.
They've experienced it before. Yeah.
And so then you traveled to receive the award?
You travel. So they call you in October. You travel in December. You get to prepare a talk and rent a white tie and tails. Neil Orson, who's the IPSCI boss, he came to Stockholm with me along with, you know, so market design is a very outward facing part of economics. So among my guests was Neil, who's involved in school choice, and two kidney surgeons, and someone who had been involved with me in redesigning the labor market for new doctors. Things like that. So I had an eclectic group, but we all looked the same when we were dressed up in white tie and tails.
Well, that's very cool. Well, thank you again for being here to speak to us today. This is a terrific talk.
Thank you for having me.
I believe this is right. You saw a picture of Dr. Ross' book on the screen there. If you've not had a chance to purchase it, copies are available outside the ballroom. Remember what I said about member benefits. I think there's some special discounts for Economic Club members. Today's presentation would broadcast on WFYI Public Radio 90.1 FM on Saturday, April 8th. It's also available for download at WFYI.org. Next month's luncheon is really sort of next week's luncheon. It's right around the corner. Please join us on Wednesday, April 5th, as we welcome keynote speakers Jennifer Vey of the Brookings Institution, and my CICP colleague, Betsy McCaw, who are going to talk about innovation districts and what's about to happen here at 16 Tech in downtown Indianapolis. Don't miss this opportunity because you're going to hear about the national theory and the local practice of something that's really going to transform the landscape here in Indianapolis. Purchase your tickets today and come back and see us next week. Information and tickets on all of our programs can always be found at our website at economicclubofindiana.com. Thank you all for coming. Terrific talk today. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Have a great afternoon. Thanks.
You've been listening to a speech from the Economic Club, part of the 2016-2017 Economic Club of Indiana Speaker Series. Join us next month at this time for a presentation from Jennifer Vey of the Brookings Institute and Betsy McCaw of CICP and 16 Tech. You can find more information at economicclubofindiana.com. The Economic Club of Indiana is a production of WFYI Public Media in Indianapolis for Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.